This morning, we're going to look at 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 17. Our subject is expectations. I really didn't have a better subject line. Of course, there are expectations in this verse. There's expectations everywhere. But you look at verse 17 with me. I'm reading from the King James Version. If you call on the Father, who without respect of persons judgeth according to every man's work, pass the time of your sojourning here in fear. Now the context in which our passage is found is about Jesus and salvation. That starts way back here, about verse 3, and continues, and you see, well, salvation enters into the picture, certainly, by verse 9, and continues on down to the rest of the chapter. It covers what's expected on the part of disciples in order to be pleasing to God. So there are expectations that God has, expectations that we ought to have as well. But also, this verse is a working example of the classic if-then proposition. Now, this type of proposition is used in life in a number of common events. For example, stoplight options. If the light is green, then you can go. If the light is red, then you stop. Of course, there's a third option. If the light is yellow, then you go very fast. At least that's what everybody does. And then also, you know, we've probably all heard this at some time in our life, whether we're remembering it or not. We've either heard it directed to us when we were small people, or we've used this with our children or grandchildren. The dinner and dessert thing. If you eat your dinner, then you get dessert. So you see the if-then proposition. This isn't something rare or something unheard of or anything like that. If you get your work done, then you can go home early. Lots of ways that this is used. Now, in our text here, if you notice, the if is obvious. It's right there at the beginning, isn't it? If you call on the Father. Or some translations may have, if you address the Father. Either way, the if is there. Sometimes in an if-then proposition, the then is actually in the proposition. But sometimes it's implied. Here, it's implied. If you call on the Father, and then describing the Father, who, without respect of persons, judging according to every man's work, the word then that's implied would come after that. It would then pass the time of your sojourning here in fear, or then conduct yourselves, whichever your translation has. So the then may not be in there, but it's implied. It's still an if-then proposition. And so we can look at it that way. Now, one of the things you see here, if you're calling on the Father, or if you're addressing the Father, whichever case it might be, and I've got the wrong word up there. That's from tonight's lesson. Let me see if I got the right thing up there. Yeah, here we go. That should be calling on the Father up there at the top. But when you're calling on the Father or you're addressing the Father, in the context here, it's about salvation. That's what it's all about. And there are a number of passages throughout the Bible. We've got a few of them up here that show us about calling on the Father for salvation. Back in the Old Testament, in the minor prophets, there's a man by the name of Joel who gives a prophecy in Joel chapter 2. Take a look over there, Joel chapter 2 and verse 32, where Joel, in the midst of a longer prophecy, says that it shall come to pass that whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be delivered, or shall be saved, if you will. And that is the prophet Joel who is quoted in Acts chapter 2 on the day of Pentecost. And again, there's the longer prophecy of Joel is found there in Acts chapter 2. And there's a different word that's used, but it still comes out the same. In verse 21, it shall come to pass that whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be saved. Delivered or saved, it all means the same thing. Saved from sin or delivered from sin. And then we find this is used again. Some Bibles in their footnotes mention that this comes from Joel. Some don't. That's kind of curious, but nevertheless. In Romans chapter 10 and in verse 13, it has that whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. So there's about three instances of calling for salvation. I don't think it's all of them, but it's the ones that use the words either call or saved or delivered in the context. But then there's another one that I'd like for us to consider here for just a moment or two. And that's what's found in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 21. It seems as though 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 21 is used a number of ways in different translations. It's kind of interesting to see how this has been rendered by others over the years. Some of them get pretty close to it. I think some of them use wording that really doesn't clear up the matter very much, might add more confusion. And I think the best is in the New American Standard Bible. I think it fits in with everything else relative to salvation. Where it says here in the New American Standard Bible, corresponding to that, baptism now saves you. Not the removal of dirt from the flesh, but an appeal to God for a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So first off, it says that baptism saves you. All right? And that's not talking about baptism in the water, like the washing away of dirt from the flesh. No, not that way. That's not the idea. But then it goes on to say it's an appeal to God for a good conscience. Now, when you think about that for just a moment or two, that here you are and you're about to be baptized and you're making an appeal to God for a good conscience in baptism, how does that work? Well, because in baptism, your sins are going to be forgiven. And that then should bring a good conscience. So this is what's taking place. It's an appeal to God for the forgiveness of sins and a good conscience. And that's what he said will happen in baptism. There will be the forgiveness of sins. Why arise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord? That's the idea that we're seeing here. So this fits in with the idea of that you're calling on the Father in order to be saved. Only here it says about the good conscience, which we would understand is in connection with being saved. And while we think about this, and that's important about the calling, that's not really all of it. You know, we're told several places that we have a calling and that we ought to act a certain way according to this calling in which we are called. For example, in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 1, I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you that you walk worthy of the vocation wherewith you are called. Well, you're calling on the Father for salvation, you've been saved, and now what do you do? Well, there's a lot of folks in a lot of places that would tell you, well, you don't do nothing anymore. You don't do anything. Forget it. It's all over. It's done. That's the end result there. But this says, that you ought to walk worthy of the vocation wherewith you are called. So if there's a calling that we enter into, there's something that's expected of us in this calling. That's right. And I might add that there's 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 10. Let's go over there. It's a calling that needs to be made sure. 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 10. Wherefore, the rather, brethren, give diligence to make your calling and election sure, for if you do these things, you shall never fall. So make your calling and election sure. Well, if we're supposed to walk worthy of the calling, then make it sure. So it appears that there's some work here to be involved. That's right. Ephesians 2, verse 10. We're God's workmanship, created for good works. That would be part of our calling. Now also in 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 10, it says there at the end, if you do these things, you shall never fall. What things are those? Well, it could be, is that things that follow after it? Well, it could be. Or is it things that come before it? Well, it could be. I think it's the things that are before this. Where it starts up there in verse 5, where it says, giving all diligence, add to your faith. And then there's a bunch of things there to add. Those are the things. So is that part and parcel of making your calling and election sure? Yes, it would be. And so one of the things that we need to realize is that if we're going to make our calling and election sure and we're going to add these things, and actually by being saved, that's not the end of everything. Well, that's really kind of the beginning of our calling. And so I guess the obvious things to point out is that this is going to require deliberate action. And it does say that you need to be diligent in this, which I think, in your adding. And it seems to me that that would be deliberate action there. Sure it would. And another thing. It's an individual responsibility. Now we'll say more about this in a little bit. But it's an individual responsibility. That means that now I'm supposed to do this. I am supposed to make my calling election sure. I'm supposed to add these things to my faith. You're supposed to do that with yours, each of us individually. Now, we might help and assist and offer advice and other things like that along the way. But there isn't anybody that can do it for you. There isn't anybody that can make your or my calling election sure. There isn't anybody that can add these things to your faith for you. I think one of the great, I don't know what you want to call it, tragedies of religion over the years is how there has developed this idea that somehow or another somebody else is going to do this for me. Think about how that's been developed. Don't go to God with your prayers and talk to Him and find forgiveness or strength from your prayers. Go to that little man over there in that booth and talk to him through that screen. Let him do it. You don't need to confess your faith whenever you're just a little baby. You can't do that. Let these people over here that stand up for you, godparents, let them do it for you. And it goes on. We kind of expect the same thing even today with personal responsibilities. We want to find somebody else to do it for us. Oh, I've got this, or there's that, and there's the other. And we've got 10,000 excuses to try and get someone else to do something for me. That's my personal responsibility. And they might do their very best. And they might be sincere and try, but they can't do it. No one can believe for me. No one can repent for me. No one can confess for me. No one can be baptized for me. But there are multiplied millions of people who think that that can be done and now actually has been done. I'm sorry you're incorrect in that thinking. It's an individual responsibility in calling, making your calling and election sure. And so I think then it goes without saying, the third point I want to put up down here. Requires deliberate action. It's an individual responsibility.
It's not going to happen by accident.
Not at all, is it? If we think about the first two, we know that that last one there is absolutely the truth. Now, our second point that we find here in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 17, is about the righteous judgment of God. And I think that's something that, you know, we really should perhaps understand that while that's referring to God, and that's a good thing on God's part, that, you know, righteous judgment is supposed to be on us as well. Now, by righteous judgment of God, He's not a respecter of persons. That's what it says in there. And you see that. That's really what the whole thing's about. Now, He's talking about how He's going to judge individuals, and it's going to be judging according to the work. But He does this without respect of persons. Think about that a little bit. Think about how far removed that is from mankind. Mankind is filled with some aspect or another, someplace, with respect to persons. Now, we'll all say, oh, no, not me. But there probably is some. And I think we all can recognize that, and we try to tell ourselves that that's not the case, when really it is. But if we'll look at Acts chapter 10 for just a minute. You know, in Acts chapter 10, when this starts out, it's really talking about respect to persons. It may not come off that way, but it really is. Because it's talking about meat sacrifice and other things like that, and there's a vision that's had, and all these things that lead up to this. And all of this is all the prelude to what the real point is. And here's Peter involved in this. And he sees this, you know, this vision, this sheet that comes down with all these animals. Rise, Peter, kill and eat. No, I've never ate anything that was unclean. Three times. I guess God's making a point, isn't He, with three times? Who'd argue about that? I don't think anybody would. And then at the end, don't call common what is clean. Don't do that. And Peter had lived all of his life about common and unclean, having that drilled into him as a Jewish boy, and clear up until he's an adult. It's just like breathing to him. And he's wondering, what's the point of all? He doesn't know. And then those men show up to take him to Cornelius' house, don't they? After that vision. And he goes along with him. Well, now wait a minute now. That Cornelius, he's a Gentile. You begin to see it? And even when Peter gets over there, he owns right up to it and says, me being a Jew, I wouldn't come into a Gentile's house. Why? Why? Because the Gentiles are unclean. Oh, they dress that up a little bit, and they say this, that, and the other. But that's the real reason there. But here he is. Over there now. And Cornelius tells him all the things that happened with him to get him to go to call Peter and to fetch him over there and that, all that. And then in verse 34, Peter opened his mouth and said, of a truth, now watch this, I perceive, I now understand that God is no respecter of persons. What made you understand that, Peter? What was it? All we've got as evidence that Peter would have perceived this, understood it now, not before, but now, is from that vision. And what was said to him during that vision. God's no respecter of persons. Now, the application of that is, that's fine, God's no respecter of persons. But the application is, I'm not supposed to be either. Isn't that right? That's how it was with Peter. And we may be so bold as to admit, oh, that's the way it is with Peter. Well, that's the way it's supposed to be with each one of us as well. Then in verse 35, it says that in every nation, he that feareth him and worketh righteousness is accepted with him. So God accepts those who fear him and work righteousness. Yeah, that's right. And here's the other side of the coin. Now that's done without respect of persons, see. In Colossians chapter 3, kind of the other side of the coin. And verse 25. But he that doeth wrong shall receive for the wrong which he hath done. And then what does the rest of it say? And there's no respect of persons in that. So he receives those, accepts those who work righteousness without respect of person, and he rejects the one who does wrong and without respect of person. God's not doing this based on whim. He's not doing it based on who they are. And that's different from the way we operate. But that's really the way we should operate. We shouldn't have this idea that there's people someplace of some economic or sociological or ethnic background, and somehow or another that we need to avoid them or whatever the case is. God's not a respecter of persons. We're not supposed to be either. Now, it doesn't mean we're supposed to be gullible or foolish or anything along that line. But we're just not supposed to be a respecter of persons. And I think it's a blessing to us to realize, that God is going to do this in a fair fashion. And so when it comes to those that fear Him and work righteous, we're really glad for that. Now, and we'll be glad for this down here as well. In other words, not just picking on us. I'm telling you, when my kids were growing up, one of them did it and then the other one did. I don't know if Jenny passed it on to Daniel or not. I don't know. And I don't think they were the ones that originated this, because I remember others saying this, and I probably said it myself. You're having trouble in a class at school. Whatever it is. It doesn't matter. Whatever it was. It was always advanced math with me. I just never could get interested in it. That's part of the problem. But it was always advanced math. What's your problem there in that class, boy? That's what I would hear. And I would be like this. And I would say, the teacher doesn't like me. That would be respect of persons, wouldn't it? That wasn't the problem. The problem was, I was just getting lousy grades. And I wasn't trying, I wasn't applying myself too much. I know what the problem, but the teacher doesn't like me. And then my kids say that. And I would always say to them, that's not the problem. It's never the problem. But we say that, and we use that all the time. Oh, that police officer gave me a ticket just because he just doesn't like me. No, he gave you a ticket because you're doing 50 and a 35. How's that sound? But see, we try to excuse that. And then we try to do the same thing. I've seen this done. I've seen it done more times than any other? In families. In families. Yeah. Where there's respect of persons that's attempted. And it just won't work. I want special treatment because that's my child. That's my child. That'd be all right for all those other kids, but that's my child. Now, that happens at the schools. Martha was a teacher's aide. She would come home and tell me about some episode where there's little Johnny in there, you know, and he's just the, oh boy, now for about 3 or 4 days, he's just been the class terror. So they sent a note home, you know, to Mom and Dad. Mom and Dad, who are not there in the classroom. And the note gets home, and they, you know, I don't know if they asked little Johnny or not, but you can imagine little Johnny's over there. Well, they just don't like me. Something along that line. And then the parents go out there. Why are you doing this to my child? Why are you saying this about my child? Well, because he's eating paste, throwing paste. He's doing this, that, and the other. Come up with a whole litany of things. And then the parent will stand right there and look at you and say, no, he's not. How do you know? You're not even here. And the eyewitnesses say that he is. No, he's not. Why would they say that? In the face of so many eyewitnesses, a busload of witnesses, you know. Because it's their child. I understand. But that's just not going to get it. And really, that's not helping your child. Helping your child would be, this is true. And they're just, the evidence is overwhelming that it's true. Maybe they ought to face the music. That would help them. More than this other stuff. But it's done. And we're not supposed to do that. God doesn't do that. Oh, well, yeah, I say, yeah. God doesn't do that. We're glad God doesn't do that. But you know what? I'm not God, and I'm kind of left out. Oh, respect the persons to you? Is that how? Here we go. Well, disciples should not have respect of persons either. And that's spelled out for us in James chapter 2. In James chapter 2, verses 1 through 9. My brethren, have not the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with respect of persons. See that? Now this isn't God not having respect of persons. That's my brethren. And he goes on. Now if there come into your assembly a man with a gold ring and goodly apparel, and there cometh in also a man in vile raiment, you have what? You have respect to him that weareth the gay or the goodly apparel there, gay clothing, and say unto him, sit thou here in a good place, and say to the poor, stand thou there or sit here under my footstool. Are you not then partial in yourselves? Yeah, both ways. Yeah. And are become judges of evil thoughts? Yeah. Hearken, my beloved brethren, have not God chosen the poor of this world rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom, which he hath promised to them that love him? But you have despised the poor. Do not rich men oppress you and draw you before the judgment seats? Well, that was what was going on, yeah. Do not they blaspheme that worthy name by the which you are called? Yes. Now, if you fulfill the royal law according to the Scriptures, then, as implied, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, you do well. But if you have respect to persons, here we go now, listen. You commit sin and are convinced of the law as transgressors. Oh, now God doesn't have respect to persons. So we're not supposed to have, you know, if we have respect to persons, the text here says, well, we've committed sin. So, serious matter, isn't it? And so, what you learn from all this is that it's not so much who it is, but it's really what is done and not done is what matters with the individual. It says now, without respect of persons, he's going to judge according to their works. So it's what's done that matters. That's what God looks at. Not the who, but the what that's taking place. And so we have passages like the one in Philippians chapter 2 and verse 12. To work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Because that's something that matters. Not who's doing this, but what's being done. And then how about Romans chapter 2? Go there for just a minute. Romans chapter 2. Verse 6. It says there, now this is referring back in verse 5 to God, that'd be the antecedent of who. who will render to every man according to his deeds. There you go. Now drop down to verse 11, for there is no respect of persons with God. Well, it's according to the, it's saying the same thing that 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 17 is saying. Now, God doesn't do that. But it's going to be according to the deeds. It's going to be according to works. Deeds and works are the same thing. There are so many times in the Bible, and they probably are here as well, they're translated from the same word. It's English deeds, and you got works over here, and it's all the same. So there's no difference in this. And that's the thing that matters with God, not who it might be, but the what. Now, as we said before, and we'll just touch on this briefly, this is our third point, our last point. But there is individual responsibility. And it says, depending on your translation, the King James Version has passed the time. Newer translation has conduct yourselves. And it means the same thing. Conduct yourselves might be a little bit better. But, you know, you've got time and to pass the time. Well, we understand, well, that would mean the same thing. And then I'm reminded of Ephesians chapter 5, verse 16, which talks about redeeming the time. And I looked at myself, I wonder how other translations might render that. So I looked at a number of them, and I found this one in the English Standard Version. And it says, making the best use of the time. Yeah, that's a good one. So you're passing the time, you're conducting yourselves, and you know what? When we're doing this, we're going to make the best use of the time. And all of us have so much time. Now that might be relative. Some might have a lot, some might have a little. One day you might have a lot, one next day you might have a little, and there it goes back and forth. I thought last Tuesday I was going to get a one-hour oil change. It turned out into a seven-hour ordeal. I put it on Facebook. I'm not going to go through it again. I just couldn't believe it. That's what I get, you know, my quick oil change. And, oh, boy, anyway. But, you know, sometimes those kinds of things happen. Sometimes you've got plenty of time. Sometimes here you don't. But we've got time. Whether a lot or a little. We've always got some. We do. So think about it. And so let's make the best use of the time that we have. And for those things that are individual responsibilities, well, if we've got this time, a lot or a little, let's use it, the time, wisely and fulfill some of those things. Seems to be pretty simple. When you think about individual responsibility. Now, I'm going to point out some passages here that I know that we're familiar with. One of them in particular, maybe not the other, but one is 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 10, that we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ and that everyone may receive the things done in his body according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad. We're not going to be judged on the basis of a group. On the judgment day, it's not going to be, were you a member of the Church of Christ? Yeah. Right on in. That would be the group judgment, you see. Maybe some people think that's the way it's going to be, and they find some solace in that. But that's not what it says here. Even in this passage here, which we probably heard countless numbers of times, points out that it's individual responsibility, each one. Now, the other passage, which may not be as familiar to us, is in Revelation chapter 22. Revelation chapter 22 and verse 12. And behold, I come quickly, and my reward is with me. Good. It's what we've been waiting on. Oh, wait, it goes on. What else does it say? To give every man according as his work shall be. Huh. That's saying the same thing over there, isn't it? Right. So individual responsibility, that's true. And then another thing, when it's talking about, comparison-wise and rejecting God, when you get to Hebrews chapter 10, that's what he's doing down there at the end of the chapter, Hebrews 10. It's kind of a comparison. You know, there were those that back in the Old Testament, they rejected God. And when they rejected God, and there were two or three witnesses for what they'd done, why they paid for it. Maybe sometimes with their lives. You see that two or three witnesses. That's what was called out whenever it was a capital crime in the Old Testament. Two or three witnesses. So we're not talking about, you know, going out here and doing something, you know, like, I don't know, forgetting to tie up your sandal or something. That's something big. But then he goes on to say, well, that's a big deal now. And that kind of a punishment for a crime. He says, of how much sore punishment do you suppose it will be to one who tramples underfoot the Son of God and counts the blood of the covenant as some unworthy thing? Whew. Pretty serious language there. Yeah. And there may be some like that. There may be some who, in denying their individual responsibilities, and they deny God, they don't believe in God, or maybe they have believed in God, and now they're denying Him. Whatever the case is, you end up over there in the bad column. And then it comes down to sum it all up down at the last and says that, well, it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Well, yeah, it is. It's really fearful. Did you notice that the last words in our passage was about fear? That there ought to be the fear of the Lord? It's the beginning of wisdom. It's the beginning of righteousness. The fear of the Lord. It's in there too. We have too much of this stuff that's being preached, and I'll tell you what, even in churches of Christ, about the feel good, wave your hands, shout for joy type of religion and belief and message that's preached over and over and over again. And we've just kind of left off this fear of the Lord. And it leads some people to think, oh, well, you know, why, that's just the big guy up there in the sky. That's Daddy up there. And other things like that, you know, that kind of downplay respect and honor toward God. Where'd that come from? Because the fear of the Lord just kind of gets left out. What's that say? It's something that ought to be thought about, respected, ought to be brought up once in a while. That there are things that we can do that aren't acceptable to God. Individual responsibility. And then, well, that's a spiritual thing falling in the hand of living God then. That's right. I think sometimes we have this idea that, well, that's just my business whether I do that or not. And it's nobody else's business at all. Really? You may be right up to a point. But on the judgment day, it's God's business. Not just yours. It's God's business. And it's a fearful thing to fall in the hands of the living God. Well, take your songbooks, turn the songs been selected. On the way of conclusion, each one should strive to do these simple things. Number one, you trust God. That's what we do. We ought to trust God. Now, by trusting God, I mean that you listen to what He says and you believe in God. And you're willing to step out and to do whatever God says needs to be done. So, you trust God in that sense. And then, you be a Christian. You do what's necessary to become a Christian according to the New Testament. You not only believe in Jesus Christ and trust in Him, but you're willing to repent of your sins, confess Him before men, and be baptized. You're willing to do that. You're willing to be a Christian. And then number three, after that, you're willing to live like a Christian. And all of those things are equally important. You're just not going to be able to be satisfactory and to please God by leaving something out in that formula, if you will. But we'd like to help you today if you'd like to become a child of God. We can assist you in doing so. Perhaps you need to be baptized. The water is ready. We can baptize you today. And if you are a child of God, fallen by the wayside, or perhaps you think that your calling isn't important and you haven't been meeting your personal responsibilities, turn your life around, do the right thing. Whatever the case is, if we can help you, we'd be glad to do so. Why don't you come all together? We stand and sing.